Microphone check. 1, 2. CC. Hello and welcome. CC. Hello and welcome.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
She sells seashells by the seashore. She sells seashells by the seashore. There we go. Rolling.
I love theatrical screenings. It's the best way to watch a movie, without a doubt. And I think that we need to be really creative in how we think about it. And actually, there's more opportunity than ever to get your film released theatrically. It's like easier than ever.
I think creating a new community of truly independent filmmakers that are more self-reliant and more entrepreneurial than ever is what I would like to see moving forward.
Hello and welcome to The Documentary Life, a show that sets out to inspire and inform you on how to best live and lead your own documentary life. I am your host, Chris G. Parkhurst, and this is episode number 72. And it is brought to you by Barong Films, proud creators of documentary film, The Documentary Life podcast, and The Documentary Academy, our industry-changing A to Z documentary filmmaking program that will transform you into the documentary filmmaker that you've always wanted to be. Find out more at thedocumentarylife.com/academy. I would like to tell you the story of a doc filmmaker. You could argue that this is an incomplete story. This filmmaker, he spent well over a year in pre-production and raising funds for his film. He put on a couple of smaller, more intimate fundraising ventures, including an auction event, then with the help of some friends, put on a much bigger cultural concert event just before leaving on his adventures, which would take him to the mountains of Nepal, where he would spend 6 weeks following herds of goats from their farmland lives in Tibet to their sacrificial deaths in Kathmandu. This filmmaker, he then came back home and spent the next 3.5 years or so toiling in the edit room, manipulating images in such a way that would eventually tell a coherent story. He and his wife ran a successful Kickstarter campaign to raise funds for distribution and the making of a beautiful DVD package that came complete with original stunning artwork of goats. Yes, goats! And it came with a slew of DVD extras, and it came with a CD soundtrack of the film. And then came that exciting day when said filmmaker was ready to unveil his little masterpiece to the world. He booked an evening at a nice, respectable theater in his town and invited people to come see his 35-minute doc that he'd been talking about for nearly 5 years. A crowd of 200 people came to see the fruits of his labor. A few of these people even bought those DVDs of the film afterwards. And then he started applying to film festivals. But after the third festival rejection for his little 35-minute film about trekking goats, he kind of lost steam. He put up an attractive-looking website with stunning images of goats and smiling Nepalese faces and incredible mountain landscapes. He priced his film very reasonably and included over 2 hours of extras. But still, the people didn't really come. Sure, sales kind of trickled in as months went by, but they were minimal at best. And slowly but surely, he lost the drive to get his film out into the world. He even started to believe that his film wasn't very good and that people probably just weren't all that interested in seeing this kind of film. And those brilliant DVD, CD packages, they just sat in a box in the back of the closet. And days went by, weeks went by, months went by, and eventually, he simply moved on to the next film project. Now, does that at all sound familiar to you? I mean, yes, obviously that filmmaker is me, and that film is Journey to Kathmandu. You'd have to be new to the program not to have figured this one out. And if you are new, welcome to the podcast. Glad to have you with us. But it may also sound familiar because this story might be you. It certainly describes many of my doc filmmaking friends, that's for sure. What's interesting to me now, looking back, is that it never really occurred to me that there were in fact people, maybe I should say that there are in fact people out there that would be interested in seeing my film, and that perhaps I simply didn't understand my target audience, or didn't understand how I could take the doc on the road, or that I could offer the film to the right groups of people who'd want to exhibit the films themselves. And the truth is, like so many of us, there was a lot that didn't occur to me on my first documentary, but certainly distribution being one of the biggest. And to this day, probably of all of the aspects of filmmaking, this is the area that I might be the least familiar with, the least experienced with. I have no problem admitting that to you. I'd be lying to you if I said anything otherwise. Now, I've done a ton of research since, and Steph and I have been arming ourselves with information on this subject, yes, but we've yet to put any of this truly into practice. So what I do have a problem with is if I continue to make the same kinds of mistakes, often simply born out of ignorance or maybe misconception of long out-of-date distribution models. You know, if I continue to make these mistakes on future films. Which leads me to today's episode. This being our 72nd episode, we've had some truly wonderful guests on the program, and we've delved into a host of topics related to documentary filmmaking here on The Documentary Life. And as you know, we always try and strike a balance between the how-tos of doc filmmaking and topics that speak to the lifestyle side of a doc filmmaker. We've talked about things like making your feature into a docuseries, shaking the proverbial money tree of film funding, practical ways to nurture your doc life, personal finances for the independent filmmaker, or even how to shoot the best-looking B-roll for your film. But the one topic that has eluded this show, and it's in fact one of the more requested topics, is that of distribution for your documentary film. Sure, we've hinted at it, most often by hearing the stories of other doc filmmakers. We've done a segment on 5 common distribution options for the doc filmmaker, but we've yet to tackle the subject of distribution head on. That is, until today. And we have someone uniquely qualified and someone who is a doc filmmaker just as you are, and someone who through practical trial and error, not to mention a very real desire to make a living as a doc filmmaker, has discovered some very real methods, and ones that are not necessarily all that complicated, in which we all can not only get our films out there and distributed in the world, but we can actually make money doing it. Yeah, I know, that probably caught your attention, didn't it? I hear you, fellow doc lifers, or should I say, I've heard you, doc lifers, because this is the show you've been asking and waiting for. Who am I kidding? It's the show that I've been waiting for. So when we come back from a quick word from our sponsor, we're going to hear the story of doc filmmaker, executive director of Documentary Foundation, and founder and CEO of Filmmaker MBA, Christopher Rufo. And he's going to give us some real and practical tips for getting our films out there and seen and making us some money from our hard-fought passions. I am your host, Chris G. Parkhurst, and I am happy to have you here with me today on The Documentary Life. Okay, hands up. Who here is living a documentary life? Would you say that you are? What does it mean to live a documentary life anyway? Well, we'll happily give you our definition. To us, living your documentary life means that you have crafted your lifestyle in a way such that you are able to make the documentary films you choose to make without it negatively impacting other aspects of your life, be that financial, your immediate relationships, or personal wellness. And furthermore, through the creation of your art, your existence is sustainable, creative, and fulfilling. Would you say this describes you? If not, is this something that you want for yourself? It was what we wanted for ourselves, and it took us quite a while to achieve it. Truthfully, there were many times we didn't think we'd make it at all. We were living in a world that was reactive rather than proactive, and it was costing us greatly. If any of this resonates with you, we'd like to help you find a better way. Because once we were able to honestly say we were living our documentary lives, we could look back and see what had gotten us there, and we knew we had to share it with others. We broke it all down and put it into Living Your Documentary Life, a program that helps you to craft your own lifestyle, relationships, and mindset in ways that empower you to make your best documentary films. You can find out more at thedocumentarylife.com/yourdoclife. I'm happy to welcome to the Documentary Life today, doc filmmaker Christopher Ruffo. Chris, it's been a while coming here to have you on the program. Very excited to have you on today and talk about a number of things. And certainly, really, distribution for the documentary filmmaker is going to be a big focus of what we talk about today. And we have such a need for that, not only with our listenership, but with doc filmmakers, really the globe over. And we will get to that, of course, but I guess I should welcome you to the program. Thanks for joining us today, Chris.
Yeah, absolutely. Great to speak with you.
Chris, you have, where should we start here? You went to Georgetown University. At that time, were you going for business or how was filmmaking playing a part of your life at that point in time?
You know, probably like a lot of folks, it really wasn't at that time. I actually went to Georgetown for the School of Foreign Service. So that's like training diplomats and, the State Department kind of career foreign service folks. And I kind of stumbled in backwards to the documentary world and got a job working overseas, kind of producing news segments and short documentary segments for a production company. And then shortly thereafter, started producing my own films, mostly overseas for the first 5-6 years.
Right.
And then for the last 5-6 years, I've produced films pretty much mostly in the U.S. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of been my journey, and it's been it's really interesting. I think the documentary career, there are no two similar careers. There's for better or for worse, there's no career path. There's really no ladder unless you're working on kind of working way up the ladder as a specialized crew or an editor or a technical person. There are some kind of career ladders for those positions. If you're a freelancer or working for a big production company, but really for most of us, if we're directing or producing documentaries, it's a wild kind of self-made world. Mm. And the IDA, the International Documentary Association, commissioned some research last year. And I think they said that like 2/3 of all documentary filmmakers in their research did not make any money from their films.
Yeah. We had Simon Kilmery on the program a few months ago, and he did mention that.
Yeah, I mean, and it's really, I think that is the core challenge, and that's something that I've taken very seriously in the past 10 years, mm. and try to offer my 2 cents to help people hopefully flip that so that actually 2/3 of people are making a living working on their films.
And Chris, is that something you came to through the experience of making a doc film? Like, we can go back to when you produced your first film, Roughing It, for PBS, and this took place in Mongolia, Roughing It, Mongolia. Mm-hmm. So did this sort of, these realizations happen during the filming of that, or were you kind of keenly aware of that going into it?
No, not aware. I mean, I think when I went into it, I figured, okay, I'll make this film. I'm making it on a shoestring budget, and then I'll finish the film, and then someone will cut me a oversized check and hire me to make films that I want. So that
one,
was
yeah.
kind of my naive dream going into it, but very quickly, kind of reality hit. And I think anyone who is working on a film or finishing a film, it's doable to raise money to get your project done. People, we've been raising money for documentaries for as an industry for, 100 years now. So I think people are pretty comfortable with how to fundraise, how to get your project made. There's more opportunities than ever with Kickstarter, foundation grants, private individuals, investors. And I think we've kind of, in a way, solved that problem. But what I found is that the actual issue now, the actual problem, is really what you do after you finish your film.
Right.
Because I was talking with a friend of mine here in Seattle earlier this week, actually, and he had a film called The Heart of the Game. And it was like mid-2000s when it came out, big festival premiere. And I think it was Miramax or one of the big companies cut him $1 million check to buy the rights to the movie. And that's like that was the playbook for many years.
Yeah,
you would
right.
hope to be one of the kind of top 3 to 5 films in a given calendar year that make a big premiere and get a huge payout. And if you look at the numbers now, that doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
There's almost no hope for that to happen. And I think the
in a way that's sad, but in another way, it's actually a big opportunity because for filmmakers now, it was always a naive hope that you would be the top three films.
That's right.
Considering there are, 5 to 10,000 films made every year. Mm-hmm. Are you really going to be the top 0.000001?
Right.
And is that really a smart gamble?
Yeah. How is that sustainable?
How is that sustainable? It's not. So I think filmmakers now are just starting to ask the question, okay, well, I've made this film. I've figured it out. What do I do now? And that's really the question that that I really struggled with and really took seriously, and was able to then kind of build a business around the films that I did. It took a while. It took a lot of trial and error. But for the last film I released, Age of Champions, yeah. A story of senior Olympic athletes, so people up to 100 years old that compete in Olympic sports. We were able to do about 1.5 million in revenues.
Right.
So, and that's almost all through what you might call self-distribution,
right,
or direct distribution. That's probably the term I like the best.
Yeah.
And in one hand, it's a lot of work. It takes a ton of time, a ton of energy, a ton of kind of strategic insight. But on the other hand, there's a huge benefit. It's, it's bigger than the $1 million check that you may have got once upon a time. But B, you can actually then, build that into something that lasts over time. You don't have to say, okay, I need to make this super monster hit documentary every 5 years. You can actually make whatever film you want. And if it's good enough, and if there's an audience, you can actually build a business so that you can be self-sustaining. I think that's the term people like to use now.
Right. And we're going to get to Age of Champions and the amazing sort of distribution and audience finding story that really is around that journey. But before we do that, I would love to hear now Documentary Foundation. Of course, you are the founders of both Documentary Foundation and Filmmaker MBA. Documentary Foundation came first, right? And it's a nonprofit organization.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about what Documentary Foundation is, how it came to be for you.
Yeah. Well, I think early on, just thinking about how to incorporate the business, I found that incorporating as a nonprofit has a lot of advantages. On the disadvantage side, it's more paperwork.
Yeah, it's a process.
It's a little bit of a process, but it has huge advantages. Some are trivial, like you get a 50% discount or on your Adobe Creative Cloud every month.
Oh, wow.
So those little things are really nice. You feel like you can save some money. But then the real benefit, the kind of big picture benefit, is that it really opens you up to a lot of different kind of foundation funding opportunities. Mm-hmm. And people there's kind of like a halo effect or kind of an implied social reputation for being incorporated as a nonprofit.
Right.
And then but the biggest benefit is that you can, you don't have to take equity investors, which if there's one thing that I think your listeners can take away from our conversation today, it's do not take on equity investors.
Mm-hmm.
I'll say it one more time. Do not take on equity investors. It's a total disaster, and it's a mistake I made with my second film.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And that's how I learned very quickly that the documentary business is, we're not software companies. We're not coffee shops. We're not kind of a startup business. We're not an oil company. So like your documentary company almost certainly will not turn a profit, and you'll almost certainly never be able to pay back your investors.
Right.
And then you're almost certainly going to burn that bridge and be totally stressed out. And there's just not the margin, with very, very few exceptions, almost like minuscule amount of exceptions, any kind of equity position, documentary project, the investors don't get paid back. The filmmakers don't earn any money. The crew that's on kind of deferred salaries never gets paid. And then everyone is unhappy. And with the nonprofit model, you can go to a potential investor and say, hey, I totally get you want to invest in my project. However, this is a project that's really based on a social value. We're looking for donors to donate kind of money to this project. You can get a tax write-off if you still itemize your taxes.
Right.
which is an immediate kind of likely a 39 or 38.5% kind of recoupment.
That's right.
On their tax bill. And then you say, look, you know, we want you to get into this project because you really want to see this project made, not because you're going to see any money at the end. And that really changes the whole conversation. And then it reduces significantly lowers the, how could I say it? It lowers the bar in a really healthy way for filmmakers, because all you have to do now is make sure that your donors feel included in the project. And they're happy to see it premiere, and they're happy to see the movie get out there. That's the bar.
That's the bar. But Chris, why do this as opposed to versus, as so many other doc filmmakers do, why not just get a fiscal sponsorship? What was the difference for you?
I mean, a fiscal sponsorship, is totally fine. I just feel like if you have your own organization, there's a certain legitimacy that comes with that.
Right.
And kind of like if you're fiscal sponsorship, I totally get it. It's I've done it for films. I've actually done it for other people through my organization. Mm. But at the end of the day, like, you want to have your own entity. There's a huge business advantage. I mean, if you want to run a business and you want to run a nonprofit documentary company, you really need to have the entity, because you need to be able to do the accounting. You need to be able to, you know, hold money that doesn't have to pass through a fiscal sponsor. You need to be able to do all sorts of things that you can't do as just an individual or a privately held kind of LLC or pass-through company,
right,
is the legal term. So I think it's great. And I mean, even for me, it's like, you know, I think you asked, like, all right, tell us a little bit about the origin of Documentary Foundation. It's like, well, I searched GoDaddy.com for documentaryfoundation.org. Seemed like the most reputable possible company name.
Absolutely.
So I picked it, you know, and I think that those little signals actually have, especially when you're starting out.
Yeah.
You know, at this point, I have, you know, a reputation, I have a track record, but man, especially when you're starting out, anything you can do to convey a signal of professionalism, seriousness, is really, really valuable, because that's really all you have at the beginning, is you have whatever you can signal. Well, take those things seriously. Whenever I see like production company names that are like Angry Monkey Entertainment, I just shake my head, because it's like, don't have a stupid production company name, because people are not going to take you seriously.
I've come across that. I mean, you have yourself. We've come across this so many times, and it's just like every time I see it, I shake my head. I'm just guys, what? I mean, here you're doing these like socially conscious films, and you're like, yeah, I don't even want to say some of the names of the companies, because I'm just like, that doesn't like coincide or align with the types of films that you're trying to make here, let alone trying to get people to invest in. You made a very conscious decision early on, Chris, that you wanted to be a documentary filmmaker, and you wanted to really live a doc life. And the Documentary Foundation, creating this nonprofit organization, makes all the sense in the world to me, as opposed to going from film to film and obtaining a fiscal sponsor. There is clearly, anybody who does any sort of research into Christopher Ruffo quickly comes out with the idea that you are certainly an entrepreneur as well as a doc filmmaker. And I think that that's part of what's very attractive for someone like myself, with what you do with both the Documentary Foundation and of course Filmmaker MBA, is this idea that you present to doc filmmakers, look, nobody's going to sell this. Nobody's going to distribute it in the way that you can do. And it's very empowering, this idea that we can be doing it as doc filmmakers. I, for one, really appreciate the entrepreneurial spirit behind all of that.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. And I think it's really an essential point, because I've noticed, you know, I'm in my mid-30s now.
Yeah.
And I've noticed over the last 10 years working in this field that there's a winnowing that takes place. And pretty much, like, you know, a lot of people get started after school, a lot of people in their mid-20s. Things are in a way easier. You just have to make your rent and beer money and keep moving. You know, it's really like a simpler thing. And then there's really a winnowing, and I think that is inevitable in this kind of business. But in another way, it's like, how can we make it so that more people are able to sustain a career over a longer trajectory? And I think that's something that
I know people in the documentary world have been theoretically grappling with, and holding conferences and writing reports and articles and documentary magazine. And I think this whole time, I think there's still a resistance to it, but right. I think that the entrepreneurship element is key. And I think there's a cultural resistance to it.
Is it because people are afraid of how they might be seen sort of as a legitimate documentary filmmaker versus a commercial filmmaker?
Yeah, but I mean, it's like I've never done with very, very few exceptions as favors to people. I've never really done commercial work.
Yeah,
I've made my living. I salary myself. I make a good living as a pure documentary filmmaker. Yeah. But the tax, in a way, is that I spend a lot of my time running the business. So I think there's a maybe among artists or creatives kind of an inborn
yeah.
Suspicion for business, commerce, entrepreneurship, and I find it funny because I've made a little bit of my reputation in the documentary world as the entrepreneurship guy.
Yeah, right.
And there's like a bizarre mix of reactions that I can kind of feel. Some are like, "Wow, that's really awesome. I want to learn from this, and this is a great model." All the way to like, "How dare you go outside the kind of hallowed institutions of documentary?" And documentarians should only be applying for Ford Foundation grants.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
Any disruption of the status quo system is kind of an abomination. And this person is a money grubbing businessman and not a real artistic filmmaker.
Well, man, I certainly would not have you on the program if I thought that way.
Oh yeah, no,
or we're like 80% of our guests.
No, I know, and that's I think, but I only reason I bring that up is that that's a really important thing I think we'll need to overcome.
Because, I totally agree.
I think that there's kind of an ossified elite documentary process that I think has less and less power and is less and less functional, less and less viable, that's funding fewer and fewer projects relative to the number of projects that are getting made. And I think that we really need to seriously step back as a community and actually question these folks that have been kind of unquestioned because they've occupied
right.
power, but really say, hey, what are we doing? What is the function of these institutions? And the reality is that they kind of control and consume a tremendous amount of resources in this world, and yet we kind of give them unquestioning deference.
Yeah,
and
we
think
do.
I think that that in a spirit of generosity and gratitude for all the things that they've done, I think we really need to kind of reformulate how we think about these institutions, and then also reformulate whether for you or your listeners, whether they're really necessary or whether there's an alternative way to get your films made and distributed.
Right, if we want to continue that or not. I have to say, Chris, that maybe one of the first times on the program we've ever had anyone use the word ossified, and I will make sure to look that up after we get off the air.
Okay.
No, it's brilliant what you're saying. I agree. I couldn't agree more. And it's such an important topic in particular for us doc filmmakers to be talking about and really examining now more than ever. I know that there are a number of you doc lifers out there who have only recently begun a documentary film or have a really great idea and are looking to start a project up very soon. We here at TDL know this feeling pretty well. It's a very exciting time when you're first starting out on a new doc project and you have the whole doc film and filmmaking experience ahead of you to look forward to. Of course, as anyone who's a listener of the program or who has done a film themselves knows, it's not all peaches and cream, this doc filmmaking thing. There will be some bumps and bruises along the way. That's to be expected. However, we'd like to help minimize that impact a little bit for you. If you go to our thedocumentarylife.com website today, you can download a free pre-production checklist ebook. And yes, we are calling it an ebook and not just a simple one-page checklist, because it's a fairly thorough look at five very specific things that you would do well not to overlook as you venture forth into your new doc project. There are some really nice tips for developing your film proposal, establishing communication with your email list, developing your fundraising strategy, and that's just to name a few. This one's on us, guys. So if you're looking to start up a new doc project or you're already in the early stages of one, just head to the documentarylife.com website to download the free pre-production checklist ebook.
Idea is to compete, and you don't have to win, but whenever you do win, it's a nice feeling.
Winning is everything, Brad. What do you mean? Good guys finish last.
With your film Age of Champions, a film that, as you said earlier in the program, you made $1.5 million on, the journey that you have taken with Age of Champions is a really, really remarkable one in terms of finding an audience for this film, because it was not who you originally thought it was it?
Right. No, it wasn't. Yeah. So Age of Champions is a feature-length doc about five competitive athletes that are between 80 and 100 years old that go to this Senior Olympics competition. So it's kind of your kind of archetypal, fun, inspiring, humorous competition doc, you know, that leads up to this big moment where they all go to compete, some win, some lose. So that's kind of what the film is. And, you know, we were lucky to have kind of the traditional support for the film. And then we took it to premiere at AFI Docs, which used to be called Silver Docs. It went to PBS. So we had a really nice big PBS broadcast. But, you know, I kind of realized very quickly after our festival premiere, like, oh, wow, this film is not going to get bought. And the PBS broadcast is not a big payout. Yeah. So, like, if I want to keep doing this, I got to figure out how to distribute this and market this and make some money with the film. So that was kind of the question. And it was very, very daunting. So if there are any filmmakers that are listening to this and you have a film that's going to be finished or a film that's already finished and even already premiered, I think everyone goes through the moment of just sheer panic. Like, what am I going to do? Where is this going to go? How am I going to, you know, pay my bills a year from now? Which is a really critical question to answer. And so basically I poured myself 100% into figuring out how to do it. And I tried a lot of different things.
Yeah. What did that look like?
So, you know, first it was like, all right, well, who would want to pay for this project? Who would want to pay for this film? Who would want to see this film? So we did like some pretty kind of lo-fi audience testing where we said, all right, well, you know, I had a very small team, just, you know, two or three people. We said, okay, well, let's call athletic groups. Let's call senior living communities. Let's call churches. Let's call, you know, rec centers. Let's call kind of city departments of aging. Let's call professors who teach gerontology. All the people we thought would have some sort of inborn interest in the subject matter of the movie. And that's really the key, I think, for anyone that has a film. Like, don't fall to the myth that there's like a general audience. There's not a general audience that you can't reach it. It's like, unless you have a $150 million marketing budget, your film is not going to break through to a general audience right away. So like, focus as tightly as possible on people that would be most interested in seeing your project. And for a documentary, that is 100% always based on the subject matter. And I think that was in a way disappointing, because you say, well, man, I'd love if, you know, this film is so great, everyone that sees it loves it. I'd love if, you know, single 30-year-old urban dwellers would come see Age of Champions. But the fact is that they won't. And it's a total waste of time trying to get them to see the movie. So after we kind of figure that out, we
I really focused all of, you know, my energy on targeting the kind of organizations and institutions in the senior health, aging, healthy aging, kind of communities. And that's really when the film took off. And in a way, it had nothing to do with the traditional documentary world, which, you know, we were successful in the traditional documentary world, but the payout was so small. Mm. Even when we got a Netflix contract, I mean, if you add up Netflix, PBS, film festivals, that's kind of like it, right? You know, your television broadcast, your right. Netflix deal, our traditional deal with like iTunes and Amazon, all those streaming services, that would be less than $100,000.
Yeah.
Out of a total revenues of 1.5 million. So it's like 7%. And really we focused on reaching all of the senior focused organizations we could, and then cutting deals with them, whether we're selling the screening kit, whether I'm going out to present the film and speak for a speaking fee, or calling, you know, striking a deal with the national AARP organization to underwrite a national screening tour. So really just hammering away at these kind of non-theatrical community screenings, DVD sales, sponsorship deals, all of those speaking events, all of those kind of non-traditional revenue sources were actually very, very lucrative. And I think that there's a huge market there that is for almost every film, you know, there's this kind of the marketing strategies will change, but the overall concept is the same. It's like, if figure out who would want to see your film, figure out what would be, how to create some value for them, and then figure out how you want to actually sell it and how you want to price it, and then how you want to actually create the distribution and marketing mechanism to repeat that process.
It's funny, you mentioned something in there about theatrical screenings, and I had recently been going over some, I'm forgetting the name of the book now. Do you know who John Reese is? He's another big distribution guy.
Yeah, John's right? Great guy.
Okay.
Yep.
And he had written something that stood out to me, and it was this idea of like redefining theatrical screenings. And I think that you have very much done that, and certainly with Age of Champions. And it's this idea of, look, theatrical screenings, the idea of getting people to come out to the theater, you know, the theater, sitting down and watching the film in this fashion, having that as the only definition of theatrical screenings is kind of ludicrous nowadays. There's so many different ways that we get people or can get people to come see our films that should absolutely be called or included in the definition of theatrical screenings. And I think the screenings that you were doing that is a perfect example of that. Can you give us an idea of what some of these screenings looked like?
Yeah, you know, there's a huge range. You know, on the kind of high end, we did a deal with AARP to sponsor theatrical screenings in 20 states, which was a huge logistical challenge, but also a lot of fun. But basically, what we did is we rented just four wall rented a movie theater in the cities they wanted. And then we worked with their local office to promote the screenings, to kind of get the word out to all their members. And then we sent them all the cool marketing materials that we had. And then I flew out on the day of the screening. I flew out, and then we had these great events where AARP would have kind of a booth and information in the lobby. You know, sometimes we had 800 people come to the screening. That was one of the bigger ones. You have 800 people filming like a theater in Albuquerque, New Mexico. They would have one of their team members kind of introduce the film. They'd show the film, and then I would come speak and answer audience questions. And then they would give kind of like typically like a swag bag to all the people that came on their way out. So it was like a really high end event. There were some that had like cocktail hours. Wow. I mean, some of the folks, you know, that would want to sponsor a screening want to make it a marquee evening,
an event,
and it's awesome. You know, that's so cool. Much richer than just you know punching your ticket to go see a movie.
Totally.
And so that was kind of like the highest end, and that would be like, you know, there'd be like a $10,000 budget for that.
Yeah. Wow.
For screening, right?
Yeah.
So you know, we could like really pull out all the stops and get paid and offer free tickets. I mean, it was great. So that was kind of your high end, and then
then down to like your lowest end, which would be a church in Fargo, North Dakota, yeah. for example, would buy the screening kit off of my website for $150.
Yep.
And then they would have like a basement, like PowerPoint projector screening to like 10 people that were in their seniors, you know, faith group or whatever.
Yeah.
So that was kind of like, so all of those things, those are theatrical screenings. People sit down together in a room, watch a film, and then they leave and talk about it. So I think that there's this kind of idea that unless your film is getting a theatrical release from a typical distribution company and it's going for at least a week in New York and LA, and you know, then you roll out to kind of art house theaters after that, that's the only real theatrical. And like, that's great. But if you actually look at the numbers, most of those campaigns lose money, and right. And they're seen as like a loss leader. But that's, to me, is crazy. It's like we have like why would you do that? I don't see the business sense.
Mm.
And the fact is, it's like, well, yeah, let's say you have your movie at the at an independent movie theater in San Francisco at the old Kabuki,
mm-hmm.
and your film screens, there's no filmmaker there, you know, your audience is like 20 people.
Yeah.
They see your movie, they go home.
Yeah, exactly.
That's cool. I mean, that's great. That's awesome. But like, for me, I'd rather have a screening where I'm making $5,000, I go to speak, and there are 800 people having a great time. So in a way, like it's almost like a musician's model where you're touring with your movie.
Mm. Especially nowadays,
yeah,
how
I think
the
it's
musician
great,
needs
know?
To make money. Yeah.
That's how they make money.
Yeah.
You know, I have a lot of musician friends, and I think that's a really important way to think about it. And certainly there's avenues like Tug, which is a really great company that is facilitating theatrical screenings in a new way. And I think that like I love theatrical screenings. It's the best way to watch a movie without a doubt.
Yeah.
And I think that we need to be really creative in how we think about it.
Mm.
And actually, there's more opportunity than ever to get your film released theatrically. It's like easier than ever. It's great. Even when I started 10 years ago, it was really hard.
Yeah.
And it was you couldn't break in. It was controlled by a small network of people. And then you'd be risking huge money trying to four-wall. And it was very filmmaker unfriendly. But I think what's happening is that theaters are realizing that, wait, there's this kind of middle market where I can work directly with a filmmaker, give them a Tuesday night, they can pack the house with their fans, and everyone wins. So I think that's really the, you know, beyond just theatrical screenings, that's really the big change. And I think that a lot of the traditional institutions are uncomfortable with it because it undermines their power. But the reality is that the distribution problem has been solved.
Hmm.
It's very easy to distribute your movie. Distribution is actually not even a challenge anymore. You can go to Distribber or Quiver, pay them $1,200, have your movie available on all the streaming services worldwide.
How do you feel about these sort of these companies that are doing that, who will take on your film for a fee? How do you feel about that? And I'm asking you from the perspective of not even as a business owner yourself, but as a say an independent documentary filmmaker. How do you what is your take on paying someone $1,200 to then take your film and hopefully distribute it?
No. I mean, if you have a film that is kind of broadcast quality or commercial quality, they will distribute it. It's not even like they're taking it to a distributor and seeing what happens. Mm. Something like Distribber or Quiver, you upload your project, and then they just kick it out to all the streaming services.
Right, right.
I don't know anyone who's been rejected. So then the real awesome part is that they just work on a fee basis.
Yeah.
They don't actually take any of the revenues. So they pass through 100% of the revenues from those services directly to you.
Mm, right.
And this is like the greatest thing for filmmakers. I mean, hands down, the greatest innovation.
That's interesting. That's very interesting that you would say it, because I actually thought you might have argued perhaps not necessarily in favor of that. And I say that, Chris, because if I'm an independent doc filmmaker and I have a film and I don't feel like I have the wherewithal to be able to distribute it and make money on that film, paying someone $1,200 to then take my film, my fear would be that, oh, okay, I just paid someone $1,200, but there's no assurance that film's going to go anywhere or I won't necessarily make money on that film. As opposed to your process, which is, as we've discussed at least thus far, which is, look, I can teach you or I can show you how to self-distribute your film, and it's go out to these places. I can get, you know, you can empower us to get our films seen theatrically and make money on films in this fashion.
Yeah, yeah, no, I hear that. I think that you, I mean, the threshold of confidence that's required is really like, can I make $1,200 with this movie? And
right.
I mean, it's such a low cost. Mm. I mean, in 10 years ago, if you wanted to screen in a movie theater, you had to create a 35 millimeter film print, and just the print.
It's 30,000 like, or something, right?
It's like 15 grand. Yeah. It's like 15 grand. So like, so, and that would be one print that you could show in one movie theater at a time.
Right.
And then shipping costs between them. So like the cost of distribution has gone from that to now you can get your film on iTunes, Amazon, Microsoft, Hulu, all these, every streaming service worldwide for $1,200.
Right.
It's so cheap if you think about it in the big picture to have a massive distribution instantly for essentially for free.
Yeah, that's wild.
So it's really, I mean, really fantastic. So what I mean by saying the distribution problem has been solved is that technically the distribution problem has been solved. Mm. There's no technical limitations. There's no essentially like, you know, there's limited shelf space at Blockbuster. So your documentary is competing for like five spots at Blockbuster back in the day. But now there's unlimited shelf space online, and like every documentary can get distribution. So the distribution problem has been solved. The real core problem now for documentary filmmakers is the marketing problem.
Mm.
And that's really what I teach in the Filmmaker MBA course.
Yeah.
Is saying, okay, how do you, once you have your film, how do you set up the distribution kind of mechanisms? And then really, how do you market your film?
Mm.
And that's kind of the key challenge. And that's what I have really loved teaching filmmakers. You know, thousands of filmmakers now have signed up for Filmmaker MBA.
Yeah.
And either for kind of the intro or for the full course.
Yeah.
And that's really the challenge is how can you build an audience? How can you market your film? And where do we go? And how can you make that sustainable in the future?
And Filmmaker MBA really, you know, it seems to me, it strikes me as very much the culmination of your own experiences and research, you know, of at least a decade of work here. And it's really, and I see, even through conversation with you, Chris, I feel a true, genuine desire to help doc filmmakers understand how they can, in fact, get their films seen, and that you can, in fact, make some money on your films.
Yeah.
And by the way, there's nothing wrong with that. And
totally.
And I think that's the brilliance of something like Filmmaker MBA. Tell us the mechanism with which a filmmaker comes to your site, and how does Filmmaker MBA work, essentially, for a doc filmmaker?
Sure. So yeah, so Filmmaker MBA is a self-paced, self-directed course that teaches filmmakers how to market, distribute, and monetize your documentary film. So it's really kind of a to Z approach, everything from the very basics of what is direct distribution, how do you do it, to then very, very kind of fine-grained tactical information, like how do you run a successful MailChimp drip email campaign?
Yeah, right.
How do you reach out to partners for corporate sponsorships? What is the best way of getting in touch with them? How do you develop your pitch? To how can you run a digital marketing campaign for your film? Mm. So really going from the broad conceptual ideas to like really how do you execute these campaigns? I created the course because I was getting so much email traffic from filmmakers saying, hey, I heard about what you did with Age of Champions.
Yeah, right.
You're doing your new film. Can we jump on a quick call and can you give me some advice on distributing my film?
Right, right.
And it got to the point where it's like, oh my gosh, I just don't have the time or bandwidth to help everyone that is reaching out to me. So I said, you know, maybe what I'll do is I'll just put all of this knowledge together in a course and then make it available online. And it was actually a really fun process to create the course, to write the lesson plans, to record the videos, to put together kind of worksheets and action plans, and then actually build out the website to make it a really kind of engaging user process.
Experience,
and then for me, what was really kind of the benefit for me is that it's a cool side business for me, but also is I can help filmmakers at scale, you know, so I can really, like, because it's self-directed, before it's self-paced, filmmakers can kind of go in, get what they need. They can always come back. The membership never expires. It's a one-time fee.
Right.
And then people are really, you know, getting a ton of value out of it. And people say, hey, you know, this saved me tons of time, or this helped me really design my marketing campaign. And I really feel like I can contribute the knowledge that I've developed over the last 10 years in a way that can reach a lot of people. And that's really fun, you know, and that's been kind of the great part about it. I love teaching this stuff, and I have kind of a dual purpose in my mind. Mm-hmm. One is, you know, I want to help individual filmmakers make money with their films so that they can go from kind of struggling documentary filmmaker to like, hey, this is my business. This is my livelihood. I can make it. I can do this. And so that's kind of my primary motivation. My secondary motivation, and building on what we talked about a little bit earlier, is to really kind of force our industry and our kind of community to change. And I think that I see a lot of good intentions in the documentary kind of industry and a lot of the key institutions, but I also see huge gaps and huge holes and huge problems. And I want to create essentially challenge that world and say, hey, you know what? If there's enough filmmakers that can fundraise for their films independently, distribute their films independently, market and monetize their films independently outside of those traditional venues, which I think are so limited in so many ways, I think that's really good. I think creating a new community of truly independent filmmakers that are more self-reliant and more entrepreneurial than ever is what I would like to see moving forward.
Filmmaker.mba is the URL. Tell us the costs that are involved for someone that wants to sign up for your course.
Sure. Yeah. So it's www.filmmaker.mba. Right on the side of the page, there's a free 7-day email course to give you kind of a taste of what the course is about. Mm. And this includes everything from giving kind of a tease of all the different lessons you'll learn. It includes a full breakdown of where exactly I earned $1.5 million distributing Age of Champions.
Right.
I actually break it down by source of revenue in a very detailed way, so you can see, okay, how did this happen? Where did the revenues come from? And then you know, the idea is that if you want to sign up then for the full course, I'll show you exactly how I did each of those pieces. So there's a free 7-day email course that is really helpful. There's a couple tutorial kind of short tutorials on the front page you can watch for free to get a taste. And then if that looks good, it seems exciting, you can sign up for the full course. It's $149, and this is a one-time fee. You get unlimited access. Your membership never expires. Mm. And you can, you know, there's 15 video lessons, a ton of one-hour webinars.
Yeah, that's right.
There's 15 case studies, action plans, templates, checklists, sample documents. You know, you can go through the course very quickly, or you can kind of pour into it and spend, you know, hours and hours and hours studying each of the individual pieces.
It, like anything else, is what you put into it is what you're going to get back. I have spent some time going through your program, Chris, and I can say that that price point is it just is a remarkable, accessible price point for any of us doc filmmakers. And what you get out of it is tremendous. There's audience building. There's obviously the distribution that we have talked about, marketing, monetization for your film, how to make sort of a social impact campaign, the entrepreneurship sort of spirit that is involved with any of these sorts of endeavors, fundraising, pitching. It's all there. And I am so happy to have had this conversation with you, Chris, not only to be discussing filmmaker.mba, but really now more importantly, post-conversation, just hearing your journey to it. And it's very inspiring to hear you talk about the possibilities that are out there for us doc filmmakers, getting our films seen and making some living by doing it as well.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate that. And it's been really fun to talk about this stuff. I'm very passionate about it. And it's great to know that that there are other people like you that are trying to spread the word. And one thing I do want to mention is that for all of your listeners, if you type in the code in all caps, MyDocLife,
You can also get 10% off the Filmmaker MBA. So it's one more time. It's the discount code MyDocLife in all caps. You know, I know all of us, you know, no matter where we are, it's always good to save a little money. And I think that's really half the battle, is trying to figure out how we can all move forward and be more successful. And I think there's a lot of room for growth in this community. And, you know, really appreciate that you put together this podcast series. And I think it's just fantastic.
We've been speaking with Christopher Ruffo, the man behind Filmmaker MBA, as well as the Documentary Foundation, and certainly a doc filmmaker himself. What a great conversation. We've wanted to have this level of a distribution conversation for quite some time. I imagine this is going to be certainly one of our more popular episodes. Thank you so much, Chris, for being on the program. We'd love to have you on again sometime.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Don't forget, if you're looking to live and lead a documentary life, you need to head over to thedocumentarylife.com/yourdoclife and take a look at our Living Your Documentary Life program. We'll help you craft your lifestyle so that you are able to make the documentary films that you want to make and live the doc life you want to live.